Accession number 28424, Reel 3.
Raymond Hands, Reel 3. As you were taking all this equipment and food and rations into the jungle, would you have to be careful in the jungle with, say, the remnants of a patrol? I'm thinking of the old cans or that sort of thing.
They were buried. But to the experienced eye, that rubbish pit would be very, very evident, I think, for days, weeks to come until growth had taken place over it. But no, they were buried as a matter of course, yes.
What about cigarette smoking on a patrol?
Smoking? Yes, we were all issued with a tin of 50 cigarettes per week per man. Very awkward thing to carry if you weren't wearing a pack, if you were out for the day. So most people used smaller tins, which went in the flat pocket. Smoking break usually once an hour. Not so much to smoke, but to have 5 minutes rest, because it was physically very demanding at times. And of course, not everybody did smoke. Those who did, did. They were alleged to be a bit of an insect repellent, and whether that was the case, I don't know. I suppose a keen nose would have smelt a patrol at quite some distance because of the cigarettes. But that's what we did, and everybody did the same thing as far as I know.
If you were on, say, three-man patrol in relatively deep jungle environment, what kind of progress could you make?
Oh, quite good. And it depended whether you're going... the jungle was really made of in map-reading terms, spurs and re-entrance. A re-entrance is a valley, which usually had water at the bottom of it, or the further down you went, certainly would have had water at the bottom of it, which was a lifeline, of course. And once you were up on top, on a ridge track which roughly went where you wanted it to go, like a walk in Epping Forest, you know, apart from the heat and humidity. But further down, it could be very slow.
You mentioned that obviously you relied a lot on the compass and the map.
Mm-hmm.
What about the quality of the maps?
Excellent. One of the great things, I suppose, that one had to be grateful for the long-term British activity, as it was a Crown colony at that time, and for many, many years had enjoyed the services of all the usual departments, health, education, and so on, and a map-making process which... I thought, extraordinarily good. There were huge difficulties sometimes in identifying which particular spur you were on, because one looked very much like the next, and of course you could get it wrong, and frequently did, but it didn't really matter. Soldiers used to say, "Are we lost?" And I would say, "No, we're not lost, but I don't know where we are." Because you couldn't be lost. If you walk downhill, you hit water. And you walk down beside that water and it ran into more water. And sooner or later, you were back in civilization. I mean, it was very basic, but that's what I always told them. I hope it cheered them up a bit. No, you couldn't always pinpoint exactly where you were. Very difficult sometimes. And certainly, of course, in swamp area, impossible. Absolutely impossible. No features of any sort. So, no. The compass was the only thing.
On a three-day patrol, what kind of sleeping arrangements would you make?
You shared four to a basher, I guess is a Malay word, and a basher was a shelter which had a poncho base. The poncho is a very heavy rubber cape, South American in origin. But of course, we never wore it as rain protection. If it rained, it rained, and we just got a bit wetter, that's all. But you would have died of heat wearing it. That was dry because it was rolled up at the bottom of your pack. And you had a lean-to roof, which was partially made with any bits of suitable timber that could be chopped down, and partially with string at each corner to a handy bit of upright tree, and four men to one of these. The night situation required an hourly change of guard sentry, I guess the patrol commander was the only one with an official issue luminous watch, so that had to be passed around by the guy, and a rotor was drawn up, and again tradition had it that the commander always shared the dorm stint, roughly speaking 5 till 6. Things didn't change. The sun came up every day at the same time, and I don't recall, certainly in my personal experience, any nighttime incident at all, and I never heard of one in camp.
Was it difficult in that environment to sleep?
Yes. To begin with, it was extremely extremely uncomfortable. Sleeping on the ground is not got a lot to recommend it, really. And I suppose, as a very young officer, one felt nervous and anxious about what might happen, what was going to happen the next day, where you've got to go, what you've got to do. Mine was always very busy. I never enjoyed a decent night's sleep on those conditions.
And what about the climatic conditions at night?
Oh, it got a lot cooler. And we wore pullovers. You got into your dry shirt and trousers, and you wore a standard army issue pullover.
On a three-day patrol, you said you were often wet most of the time.
Yeah.
Did that have any bodily effects? I'm thinking of infections or, potentially like...
Everybody is a physical sample of one, and they react in different ways to this sort of problem. The standard physical problems were tinea, foot rot, and that was rigorously inspected once a week or once a fortnight. And jungle sores, which usually were caused by a leech. And indeed, I personally had a week off in hospital with huge inputs of penicillin daily. In those days, a syringe was a fearsome sight. It honestly looked like about half a pint. And this happened twice a day. Left side in the morning, right side in the evening. Backside in both cases. And it wasn't uncommon. That was quite a common thing.
Had that been caused by an infected
leech bite? Yeah, which I didn't know about.
What had actually happened?
It just turned horrible and infected. And I suppose nowadays it would have been treated by antibiotics and it wouldn't have been the problem it was then. But not nice.
Would you carry out foot inspections during a patrol?
No, they were done in camp. Washing was difficult. Occasionally one had running water reasonably adjacent, and if the time was right and so on, then you would take it in turns with people on guard to strip off and have a decent wash, but these were infrequent.
Would you shave?
No. But I can't remember now what if there was a rule about it or whether, you know, it was just thought to be unsoldierly. I was only 19 at the time, so there wasn't a great deal of growth anyway. But there were people who obviously needed to. I think mostly what one did was probably shave on the last day so that you arrived back looking fairly smart insofar as you could.
We've kind of talked generally about patrolling and that sort of
thing. Yeah.
Kind of left the narrative a little bit after you'd done the training days. Where were you posted to?
Kajang.
To which company?
B Company.
What was the organisation of B Company?
Three platoons commanded by two national servicemen and one regular. He was a full rank lieutenant. We, of course, were second lieutenants. And the company commander. There was no 2IC, as would be the case normally in European conditions.
And what was the company camp like as such?
Kajang was had been built around a former schoolhouse, and it was divided by a road, a public road, not a very big one. And on one side were the tents of the men, and on the other side, and within the compound of the schoolhouse building, were the stores and the officer accommodation, which was actually in the schoolhouse, and the railway line ran more or less straight down the side of that camp. And we slept two or three to a room upstairs, and the mess, of course, downstairs. The transport park was on the other side of the road, also the cookhouse. It was comfortable enough. You slept in a bed with a mosquito net and sheets. It was not unpleasant.
And how much threat was there to say a company camp really from the?
Well, in this case, probably not much because it was almost in an urban area. But the single company locations, I think particularly of the one I went to next, which was on a rubber estate north of KL called Bukit Dara, and on that estate, which is a working estate, was the base of the local police lieutenant. Now, these were usually former colonial police sergeants. A lot had come from Palestine. And he lived with his wife in what had been the planter's bungalow. And we lived round it in tents. And a huge perimeter floodlit, which was patrolled, and that I guess could always have been the scene of some terrorist activity, if only lobbing grenades over the fence. That was always a possibility.
Were you posted quite quickly to the single company position, or did you spend some time?
They rotated, probably a 3-month rotation. So that you brought new faces to an old experience, as it were. So it might be that you might have been in this area for 3 months and you got a bit blasé about where you were going, what you were going to do and what you were going to find, and suddenly you found some completely new situation, and so you had to start all over again. That obviously was a good idea.
And when you say in the single company position, mm. what kind of role did you play? Were you very much left to your devices?
Oh, no, we were. The company commander was totally in charge, and as I said, with his regular contact with the local police office, and decisions were taken on a daily basis as to what was to be done. And at that time, with our three platoons, we were, or could be, six patrols, and that's roughly how it worked.
So what were the first kind of experiences you had as you'd gone to the company? What were the first sort of patrols that you took part in, and any contacts that you had, that sort of thing?
Digress a bit here first. Very soon after my posting to active service, as it were, was of course the most memorable occasion of the entire emergency, and that was the ambush of the High Commissioner, Sir Henry Gurney, which I think was October, and I probably had been active for maybe 6 weeks prior to that, so yes, that would be about right, arrival in August and then the training, and yes. So that was the first thing, and it was all hands to the pumps then, of course. The entire military situation was harnessed and organised in an attempt to find the perpetrators of that ambush. But otherwise, it was the normal local work and contact twice in that period. Near the Bukit Dara estate was a huge jungle reserve called after its peak, which was the Bukit Bentong. Bukit is hill. This is a substantial area of high jungle, and a very substantial area for bandit activity because it was so near, in probably not more than 15 miles from KL, I suppose. And as I said earlier, the sources of supply were the main thing for them, let alone the activity they were engaged in. They had to be fed. I was led on that occasion by what was called an SEP, Surrendered Enemy Personnel, who were, well, quite apart from whatever reward money they got, and I imagine was substantial, appeared to have no compunction whatsoever in leading soldiers against their former colleagues. And I subsequently realised that because of the way the Chinese mind works, there are probably a lot of old scores to be settled, and maybe this is a way of doing it. Very clannish, very tribal. And I was led in this reserve up a very, very steep hill face, which had, strange enough, a great deal of rocks, boulders in it. It must have been the subject of some form of earth movement eons ago, but it was very unusual. And our target was an Indian bandit leader of some status, and very unusual to find an Indian in that role. I suppose 95% of the people in the jungle were Chinese. And this camp was where he was known to be. And the approach, as I say, was extremely difficult. Shots were fired by us on sighting the camp because there was evidence of action and visibility of people. But none, I think, fired back. And by the time we got there, the place, of course, was deserted. That was hugely down to inexperience. I can see now, looking back, the approach should have been entirely different, but because we were following this guy, and he was a chap who knew where we were going, to that extent, I suppose I can exonerate myself, but I should have, you know, someone with more experience at that time would have probably said, no, hang on, let's see how we're going to do this. So that wasn't successful.
Can I ask a couple of things about that? How trustworthy to you, obviously, in that very initial stages, was it to be led by a surrendering person?
It was the only occasion that ever happened to me, so I can't compare it. They had no compunction whatsoever, and the fact that they volunteered to do this, what you're suggesting is that they might have been leading you into an ambush attack, which of course would have lost their own life as well. So I think probably you were fairly safe from that.
And what did the camp consist of?
This particular one, I said, because this curious terrain was very, very well sited, probably could have accommodated a dozen people, and had more or less running water, which is a luxury. No, it's a very, very well positioned camp. Never saw anything quite like that in any other time.
And you mentioned that the leader of the CTs was an Indian.
Yep.
That being a rarity.
Yeah.
How much knowledge of the target did you have at that time?
Oh, very well documented. One was briefed when we knew who he was and where he'd been and what his record was. Oh yeah, no, a lot of information available.
And would they generally, it's just a general question really about approaching the camp, would there normally be a guard on tracks into the camp?
Yes,
and out of the camp?
Yes, there would. But as I say, this was not through the front door, so we didn't meet anybody. Yes, there would normally be. Unless you had absolutely pinpoint information, you came upon these usually as a complete surprise to you and to them, and that was your advantage.
Would they also in their camps provide escape routes away from
the camp? Yes, they weren't. They weren't likely to hang about in the event of an attack.
And would the camps then provisioned, would there be supplies of food there or supplies
yes.
of arms?
Yeah, well, they would carry their arms with them, and whatever food was there would be there and would be destroyed by us, of course, and burnt, as I say, the actual buildings, which would be the same sort of buildings we lived in when we were out, probably made of wood and brush and attap, which is a sort of frond-like fern.
And would you be, on discovery of a camp like that, looking for specific things? I'm thinking maybe of documents or items.
Oh yes, 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 yes. You did a thorough search, but they really, I don't recall, in my experience, ever finding anything that was subsequently of any information use whatsoever. At this stage, camps would be quite small, maybe three or four people only, and very mobile. They didn't stay too long in case, you know, the routes were discovered, tracks were made. Tracks, yes. Now I want to talk a bit about tracking. You probably know that the army recruited trackers from Borneo, mostly Ibans, which was their race. They were in the main extraordinary chaps and could tell who had been where and when and how long ago by looking at things on the ground, which to you and me would have revealed nothing. And the most common thing they could tell you was babi, which is Malay for a wild pig. And on the one hand you were disappointed, on the other hand you were pleasantly surprised, because you didn't know the babi might not have been three or four CTs. But they were, in the main, very, very good. They carried their own rations and extraordinarily the original Lee Enfield rifle, which is a hugely heavy thing to carry under those conditions. But it was their present from the government on going home.
How did they get on with the troops?
Fine. They lived their own life. There was two of them, and they shared the food and accommodation on patrol. The problem was communication, because we only, any of us, had a few words of Malay. We had quite a number of liaison officers who travelled with us on patrol, who were Chinese, but of course spoke fluent Malay, which was the language of the country. So that if you had one of those with you, then you had no problem, but that was by no means always the case.
What impressions did you get of the lifestyle that the CTs were living in these camps at that stage?
Unspeakable. Constant anxiety as to being hunted and chased, and constant anxiety where the next meal was coming from, and what happened if you were ill or injured.
You mentioned, obviously, in that first contact that you made, mm-hmm. obviously slight inexperience with the initial
yep.
contact. Was there a frustration there for you afterwards of...
No, these things happen so quickly, and the adrenaline is rushing about in all directions, and you look back and say, well, I can see now how this could have been done in a more successful way. But no, time is so short, there's no time to think at the time. You think later, maybe.
And you mentioned a little bit about visibility. Does that always play a very large impact on
yes,
anything,
yes,
any operation
yes,
like that?
Yes. You could walk. You could walk past a camp at 30 metres and not know it was there. And that did indeed happen to me.
You mentioned a second incident.
A camp in a different part. We were on detachment in a different part of... of Selangor, north of Kale, because regiments had time out. There was a rest and retraining period, maybe once a year. And of course, we also had time out, so we had 36 hours off every 10 days or something like that. Yes, this was near. North of a town called Rawang, a jungle age camp which we had been given some positive information about, it had a very easy escape route. It was on the side of a hill, and we never got really to within shooting range before the alarm was raised. I of course couldn't tell you how, because we never actually saw anybody, but we knew we heard them, and they had all gone very, very quickly by the time we got down the last few feet of hillside, as it were. So that wasn't an action as such. And
how does noise travel in the jungle?
Well, it's a hugely noisy place. The canopy is talking to you, shouting at you, so there is a lot of noise, and you can be moved quite quietly. And the more experience you've got, the more quietly you're moved. And you spoke, but you spoke very quietly.